Hey everybody, Adam Chartov, your host of Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 472 of the podcast. I hope this finds you well. As I recorded this episode and I'm posting it the same day, it's Thursday, March 29th, 2018. Spring has sort of come to New York. We're now experiencing weather in the 50s. It's a little bit mild, no chill in the air. It's so nice, isn't it? Have you taken a moment and gone onto iTunes and thrown me a little bone of and shown me a little love and posted a review or give me a star rating? Because it would be great if you could do that. I'm just putting it out there. This all helps all sorts of people find the show, and that's a great boon to a podcast like mine, which really just grows its audience mostly through word of mouth. I want to mention, do a little housekeeping, as they say. This week, I did a guest appearance on my friend James Hancock's podcast, Wrong Reel. It's a great podcast where I just call it deep dives, where he brings on a person or people every episode and does a deep dive into, either a movie or a genre or a year in a film or a director, which is the case with us. I said, hey, let's do an episode on a slightly less known director named Stuart Rosenberg. And he jumped at it. He knew, of course, this guy is like a self-professed freak show, as he, I think, refers to himself. I think it's episode 370. Was it 373 of Wrong Reel? I'm going to take a quick look. As I'm doing my podcast, I don't know if that's considered unprofessional, but I want to help him out. It's called Wrong Reel. Yeah, it was episode 373. It's a tribute, if you will, to the career of a filmmaker, Stuart Rosenberg, who, you may not have heard of because he never got quite the name brand recognition that, a number of his peers had. Even more obscure filmmakers that are not household words like Don Siegel and folks like that, more people know about him because of they were just more visible, I suppose. But Stuart Rosenberg really was the name behind the film. So, but his output was incredible. Of course, he had been making TV and smaller films for a while, and then in 1967 he came out with Cool Hand Luke, and then just even though they weren't all big successes, he just made a bunch of great worthwhile movies. I mean, they're all worth seeing. And a couple of other titles is like The Amityville Horror, which there are two camps about whether how good it is, and The Laughing Policeman with Bruce Dern and Walter Matthau. And finally, The Pope of Greenwich Village, which was maybe his last big name movie. Anyway, check out The Wrong Reel, and you can hear me and James talking about that filmmaker. And it's a great pleasure to do other podcasts. I've done a few. As a matter of fact, I did one not long ago. I'm not sure I mentioned on this podcast, which is not good of me to have not done, or it was bad of me to have done. That was the Criterion Now show, and that host of Criterion Now, his name is Aaron West, will be on this show. In fact, I was going to put up that conversation today, but I ended up talking to Lynn Shelton, who's on this episode, and that came together kind of last minute, in the sense of I just didn't know if it was going to work out until a few days back and if I was going to be able to post it in time. So I apologize to Aaron. We'll put that show up as soon as possible. But on this episode, number, 472, we have a conversation with a returning Lynn Shelton. Lynn was on way back, episode. This is incredible to me because I thought she's been on more frequently, but I've interviewed her four or five times, but I was interviewing Lynn Shelton way back before I even started the podcast, and I was writing articles and writing up interviews. But if you're interested, you can go back to episode number 160 and find my conversation with Lynn around the time she released Touchy Feely. And I think since then she's had Laggies, and I'm trying to think if there was any other, I think that's it. Laggies and now. So I didn't talk to her around Laggies, but now she has a new movie called Outside In. And it stars Jay Duplass, and, you know, many people now know quite well from many films and as a producer, as an actor. He was in, of course, he's a regular in the Transparent series. And he is plays opposite Edie Falco in this great film. I saw it at South by Southwest. And I did run into Lynn there in Austin at a party for the film, but I didn't get to really, you know, I didn't know. I'm just so happy. So thanks to everybody who helped me set up this interview with the returning Lynn Shelton. That will be coming out now, The Outside In. All right. After serving 20 years for the crime of essentially being in the wrong place at the wrong time, 38-year-old Chris, played by Jay Duplass, is granted early parole thanks largely to the tireless advocacy of Carol, Edie Falco, his former high school teacher. As Chris struggles with the challenges of navigating the modern world as an ex-con and with a frugal, with a fraught relationship with his brother Ted, played by actor Ben Schwartz, Chris ends up confessing his romantic love for Carol, a love that, given her marital status, Carol cannot reciprocate. Or can she? Carol longs for something her husband no longer provides. Meanwhile, Carol's daughter Hildy, played by young actor Caitlin Dever, befriends Chris, finding a kindred spirit in this awkward, tormented older guy. Now, this movie is going to be opening up on March 30th, which is tomorrow, in New York at the Quad Cinema. Lynn will be at the screenings. In fact, the Quad Cinema is located at 34 West 13th Street. And Lynn will be doing Q&As and meeting her audiences anyway. If you run into Al Pacino at the Quad while you're going to see this film, that should be pretty exciting for you. Lynn will be at the 7:10 screening. It says here, Friday, March 30th, Q&A with the director Lynn Shelton, moderated by Ira Glass. She didn't mention that on the podcast. So you can meet Lynn and Ira at the Quad Cinema for following this, I guess, you know, the 7:10 screening right after that. Check it out. Jay will be doing the Q&A at the Lemley NoHo 7 in L.A. Check their website for details because I don't really have that at my fingertips. The film is being distributed by our friends at The Orchard, where I actually sat with Lynn just yesterday and knocked out this conversation about here. Then we're going to follow up with a conversation with old friend of the podcast, filmmaker, documentarian, Sam Pollard, back for his third visit on the show. This is my conversation with the director of Outside In, returning to Film Wax Radio for her second appearance, Lynn Shelton.
We're a free man in America. Look at this. His first beer in 20 years.
Okay, everybody. Chris's high school teacher is here. If it wasn't for you, Chris would still be in jail.
Holy moly. You're real.
You're going to come over and you can get to know Hildy and Tom.
He's here. Congrats on your release. Maybe now I can get my wife back.
Soon thereafter. But at any rate, sidebar. So your sister, then Touchy-Feely premiered at Sundance. And I think it also had a summer release, but there were a lot. It was exactly the same thing. It was the distributor just kind of deciding that they didn't want it to go to South by reason. So anyway, I was really, really pleased that they were excited to do that this time. And I just was really happy to go back. I love that festival so much.
Well, you brought up Hump Day because it was your last time you were at South By, and it's coming up to a 10th year anniversary.
Yeah.
And you know, told me that, or reminded me of that.
Probably Adam Kirsch.
Well, that's a good guess.
Or Joshua Leonard.
You're very good at this guessing, because or they must be kind of putting their heads together. Yeah.
Well, I think it's all coming.
Are they pitching you something?
They are. They are pitching me something.
Well, Joshua Leonard, who's just I just had on because of Unsane and the new Soderbergh. He's one of the stars of the new Steven Soderbergh film. I mean, he hasn't. It's not like he's relying on a Hump Day sequel. So for him to do that just means he loves what you've done, your relationship, and this character, these characters. And it does seem like a great idea. I'm just putting in my own two cents.
Yeah, no, it's true. And the ideas that have come up, because I have to say, I mean, for me, a sequel just in general, it's nothing against, you know, those characters or that movie. I freaking love that movie. It changed my life, that movie. Right. Everything about it, I love it. But I just don't think in terms of sequels. It's just not something that, you know, I sort of feel like I make a movie and I just want to spend that amount of time with those characters, and then I'm happy to, you know, that know that they live on in the minds of their, you know, the people audience that, and the people who enjoyed the time with them. But that being said, you know, I mean, if you look at Linkletter, like the Before series, for instance, is pretty great, you know, and the idea of checking in again with characters that you got to know, it's there's something inherently fascinating about that. I can see the draw.
It depends also on which characters and what, you know, I mean, a lot of sequels, that the reason they get a bad name, or at least why you're thinking of it in those terms, is because there's always this financial imperative to do the sequel based on a commercial success. Therefore, you're repeating the exact same formula. Mm-hmm. We go to these and they're familiar. It feels good to see them, but we're seeing basically the same thing we saw in the original. So it's sort of like
I would want to avoid a retread. Yeah, some sort of a feeling.
That's not the incentive with this. Right. There's nobody who's probably, I don't know if a distribution, maybe I'm wrong, but it has a distribution company come and said, we have to do Hump Day 2.
Yeah, no.
So this would really be an organic kind of thing that people really do want to, and
do
I believe.
For love, yeah.
Yeah. And even though, I mean, you're right. What's the Midnight films, that felt a bit more done for fans, and also just out of real sort of desire for all three of those people to really kind of excavate a bit more into those lives, and they improved.
And you know, it's true, and it's really interesting to see what does happen to, you're essentially the same person, and yet you do change over time. How much has changed? You know, all of that is all those questions are really interesting.
Right. Anyway, I've said my bit. I've endorsed this idea. I will do what I can to make it happen, just because I enjoy Josh and Mark and that's how I think I discovered you. And now it feels like with Outside In, I don't know how to put this. So I'm only sound encouraging. It feels very much like a very new stepping into a different sort of tone for you, and at the same time, it may be just also return to this universe you've created, going all the way back to, well, we go way back, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it feels like the Lynn Shelton world, but at the same time, it's a bit, it's a little bit edgier for you, a little darker sort of themes going on.
Well, it's the first
here.
Drama. I would call it definitely a drama.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, all of my films have had some dramatic elements, probably.
And comic tension.
We go way back. Right. And Touchy Feely probably had the most, I would say, darkest areas, but all of them up to this film could be called, and rightly so, dramatic comedies. I think they have enough comedic elements that they really are proper. Mm-hmm. Again, not really outright comedies. Maybe Hump Day you could call an outright comedy. I feel like all the rest of them are dramatic comedies. There's definitely that element, but they're definitely comedies. This one has a few lighter moments. I really was aware of that at South By. It was like when people were given permission to laugh, they took it, which was great. But still not enough laughter to call it a comedy by any stretch. So yeah. And I've said for years that I never saw myself directing a drama. So it was really fun. And, you know, it was really kind of exciting to realize that I was in that realm and I was really going to allow myself to go there, you know?
Yeah. And you wrote it with Jay. Is he bringing the dark?
Well, I don't know.
Are your instincts kind of more
necessarily. It's funny. It's interesting to try and go back and think about the things that we each brought, you know. And it's hard to really identify. A lot of it was just so mutual, you know. I mean, it started because he was pretty deeply engaged from the start, even though I had sort of ownership of the document for the first few months. It was... you know, he was my muse. I wanted to come up with a movie for him, and I found out he had this hole in the schedule, and I was like, okay, well, let me look through the drawer of ideas that I have had, you know, percolating for a while. And I thought, well, this would be an interesting character for him. It might be too much of a stretch, or he may feel too challenged by it, because this guy has no overlap of life experience with Jay Duplass, you know, himself. Mm-hmm. And it feels like such a cultural, you know, a shift culturally. And, you know, it's a challenge to play somebody like that, who's had such an intense experience in his life that you haven't. But as soon as I thought he could do it, and as soon as I asked him, you know, he leapt at it, which was great. And he was so, you know, when I originate a film around the muse of an actor, which I've done many times now, I like to incorporate, I do it early on. I'll pitch them an idea really early on. And then as much as they're willing or interested in participating in the development of their own character, I want their input because it's going to fit them like a glove by the time they actually are on set, and they're going to be more invested in it, and it's just going to be better all around. Mm-hmm. So he was deeply engaged from the very beginning, and as I was evolving the treatment, I would share it with him and he'd give me his input, and, you know, we'd talk, and it was all incorporated. And then at a certain point, you know, when it got far enough along and I converted it into a script format and it became a real script. Somewhere along that process, he asked at a certain point if he could do a pass on it, and then he gave it back, and I was like, well, I'm not crazy about this and this and this, but this is pretty good too. And then at that point, we decided we should just start trading it back and forth and just be co-writers, you know, because it was just, we became so
enmeshed together.
Yeah. Sure. And it was really interesting. There definitely were ideas that he had that I liked and ideas, and, you know, that we both had ideas that we both either liked or disliked. You know, we both have very strong minds as artists, you know. So there were certain things that came up that were like, oh, God, wow, I would never have thought of that. You know, and there are definitely elements like that, I think, for each of us. You know, we both contributed things to the script that we wouldn't have had we written it on our own, which is really exciting. You mm-hmm. know, it's really, for somebody who's not used to that, it was really invigorating and exciting.
Yeah, like for instance, Jay plays a guy named Chris who's been released early from a 20-year prison sentence.
Well, he's been in for 20 years. He would have been in longer.
It would have been of course, that makes yeah. sense. So he was released in large part due to Carol, this former teacher of his, is her relentless work advocating for him and his freedom. Carol's played by some Edie something or other Falco, who I met at your... I have such a wise ass at your party that you had at South By. I said, good luck with the acting gig, just because, you know, I'm awkward around people, and I just, humor helps me anyway. I don't know if it helps my relationships, but anyway, so she gets him, she successfully helps get him out of prison, and he's like, it's almost like, you know, in love with her. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a syndrome around that, but you know, anyway, so he moves in back with his brother, who... I don't want to get too much more into the details because that's up to the people to go and see the movie, which, by the way, is opening this Friday, which is the 30th. Thank you.
Yes.
In New York and in L.A. at the Lemley NoHo 7. And then on the 3rd, it's going on platforms.
Yes. And in New York, platforms. It'll be opening at the Quad.
Oh, it is at the Quad Cinema?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Yeah. I'll be at the Q&A for the 7:10 showing, and Jay will be at the NoHo Lemley for the 7:00 showing Friday. Yeah.
Oh, there's so much now I'm realizing to cover, because you got Edie Falco, which is just this coup, and she's perfect for, you know, you think
that woman can do no wrong, literally. She's incapable of one false, even vaguely false note.
Right.
Crazy.
Now, they had a shorthand a little bit because they had done a movie earlier last summer.
Yeah, very briefly cross paths on set. I mean, it wasn't a ton of acting together. You know, they weren't really playing off each other. But just spending time being on set, you know, for a couple days. I mean, the thing is, part of the job of an actor, I've realized, mm-hmm. is that you have to be able to have the ability to create an instantaneous connection with somebody else who is going to be enacting acting scenes with you, especially if you need to have real chemistry. And in order to do that, sometimes instantaneously, sometimes if you're lucky over the course of at least a few hours, if not a few days, mm-hmm. then you really need to come to each other with just completely open heart and open mind and open arms. And I've seen it happen again and again. I mean, it just blows my mind every time. But, you know, I saw it happen with Keira Knightley and Sam Rockwell. I saw it happen with Keira Knightley and Chloe Grace Moretz. I saw it happen with Emily Blunt and Rosemary DeWitt, who had to be, you know, sisters instantaneously. They sort of spent all night the night before they started shooting, you know, just telling each other stories and cozying up by the fireplace. I mean, they just do it. They know how to do it, you know?
Okay, I guess it's you're not taking credit for kind of creating that kind of environment or just being really just sort of having good casting.
I mean, I encourage them to spend time together, but I don't have the budget to give them weeks together, you know, to really hang out. And I find it's actually just more useful instead of rehearsing or going over lines or working the material, which I just find will sort of deaden the material ultimately. Just being in each other's physical presences. Like with Touchy Feely, I actually had a night where I was able, and I happened to be in LA, and most of the other actors happened to be in LA, and so I got them all to come over, and I made dinner. I just made, you know, veggie curry for everybody, and we just hung out for like 3 hours, and we sort of talked about the movie a little bit. Mostly, we just hung out and got to know each other and got used to each other's presences. It makes a huge difference. It's really, really interesting. But again, it's like they're not guarded people. Mm-hmm. You know, these are people who emotional availability is their currency. You know, if they don't have that on set, there's no movie.
Yeah. And I mean, from there, I'm just going to step out and conjecture that from their perspective, this type of story is so welcome because it does give them the opportunity to kind of really just sort of digest this character. And it's a great opportunity just to immerse yourself in a real character study as opposed to so many of the other films that maybe come across their, you know, desk or what have you.
Right.
I'm just guessing, though.
Absolutely. But I think it was definitely that. I mean, Edie said it was, she had a good impression of Jay, which is great already, preconceived notions about how fun it might be to work with him. But she also, you know, the script really appealed to her. It felt like the way real people talk, and the way that the interactions were so complex and layered and interesting really appealed to her. And I think just the role as well for a woman of her age is not, it's few and far between a role that's as emotionally, again, complicated, rich, you know, layered. It's just not territory that people her age and gender are allowed to explore often.
Mm-hmm. And then there's Caitlin Dever, mm-hmm. who plays Edie's married, which complicates, of course, this relationship she has with her former student, Chris, who, by the way, they're both adults at this point. There's absolutely nothing inappropriate about them having a relationship, except Edie's character, Carol, happens to be married for a long time. The marriage is sort of going through a stage, let's put it that way. They have a grown daughter, who's played by the aforementioned Caitlin.
Mm-hmm.
And then Caitlin is also kind of going through a phase of her own where, you know, adolescence, I guess you call it, where she's connecting to Chris, you know, and that's, I wonder if that actually, when you were talking about Jay and what he brought to the story, I wonder if he brought in some of this interesting thing, because, you know, that relationship, of course, could be perceived as complicated and like just fragile or that's not the right way of putting it, but
well,
you know what I'm getting at.
Yeah,
know?
No, it is complicated and layered, and it's one of my favorite things about the film is, you know, I love relationships that are not sort of sanctioned by the people. You know, we're sort of given these little boundaries of the kinds of people, circles of the people that we should be able to relate to and the people that we're supposed to be interacting with and having real connections with. And, you know,
so everybody
so
feels
Chris
comfortable.
Chris and Carol both are two people who aren't supposed to be connecting on paper for a variety of different reasons as deeply as they do. And also Hildy and Chris,
Hildy's daughter,
who's 18 and he's 38 and he's an ex-con and, you know, she's a teenager. And that is not supposed to be something that is okay for them to be friends. It looks really sketchy on the outside. But the fact of the matter is, it's genuine, and there are actually, if you look at the number of there are a number of reasons why it works. I mean, for one thing, he basically is the same age as she is emotionally, because he went to prison when he was 18, and his development as a human adult basically stopped at that point.
That's a good point.
So he's kind of a boy interrupted. So that's why when he comes back to town, you know, the first thing he does to feel like himself again is to grab his bike that he used to ride everywhere and go to the skate park and hang out with the kids, because that's where he's sort of comfy, you know, and that's where he feels like, oh, let me pick up where I left off. I mean, it's so
what's his brother's excuse?
I know, right? His brothers are stuck there too. Yeah,
it's an interesting sort of subplot or thing going on there. He moves in with, as I mentioned, his brother, who was around when Chris went to prison, and there's some tension there around that. Mm-hmm. And but I'm just kind of, it's funny because he's sort of living in a frat house, or that kind of mentality where he's living in a
exactly. He's as old, but he's sort of also living in this. He's a little stunted for sure. Yeah, he's got that, and you're right. He has no excuse.
right.
But also,
well, he's been in maybe some sort of pain and in some sort prison himself.
He's been his own
self imprisoned in a way.
Self-loathing. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. For
basically. Yeah, and so yeah, the other reason I think Caitlin's character Hildy and Jay's character Chris connect is because they both in their own ways they both really want to connect to Carol, Edie Falco's character, and are unable to do so as deeply as they would like to for their own reasons, and so connecting with each other is almost this way of connecting to her. For each of them, it's like a replacement. It's very interesting. I just think there's so many different layers to it, and I think she also could very possibly be starting to get a crush on him, but that's not the main thing. That's not and he definitely he's madly in love with her mom. He's not, has no designs on her,
right? The Stockholm syndrome, that's what I was trying to say before. This is a variation on that a little bit.
Who's being kidnapped?
No, wait, it's not kidnapped. But
what are
there
you talking
is a
about?
No. You're right. I was. That's the wrong one.
The wrong syndrome.
There's a kind of a syndrome.
Oslo syndrome.
That's good. I'll take that. My apologies. It's called Outside In. It's directed by Lynn Shelton. This is your
seventh
feature, and
it feels like a body of work, doesn't it?
It's
crazy.
Not counting even all the television.
Yeah.
Stuff you've done. Are you, but you're writing, or are you just director for hire most of the time?
No, I haven't written yet for television.
Okay.
That's not true. I wrote one thing, which was a pilot. I went in, pitched a series with my buddy Megan Griffiths and Greg Feinberg, the producer. He just most recently produced Big Little Lies, but he's been on all kinds of things.
Yeah, love that. That was great.
And series. We went in, the three of us, and they made me do the full pitch, and they bought it in the room. It was great. HBO bought this thing. So they paid me and Megan to write the pilot and kind of like a breakdown of what the first season would look like. And then they didn't decide to go with it. But that was, it was very exciting to be paid something, tiny minute amount, and to actually get to map out a TV series was really fun.
What does that mean for that property? Does that mean that that's sort of just sitting in limbo? Do they own it now because they paid you for it?
I guess in the past they would often, if they would put something in development like that and then not greenlight it, which they have a huge, I guess, like giant closets full of those. They supposedly, it's up to them whether they want to keep it or let it go. And they actually gave us permission to take it out. I think there may have been some caveats. Like, I don't think we were supposed to take it out to direct competitors like Showtime, other premium cable channels, but basic cable and streaming or something. I can't remember exactly what the parameters were, and I think our agents went out with it a little bit, but anyway, it just wasn't to be, so that's all right. We got busy with other stuff, so it's all fine. But yeah, mostly my experience on television has been just guest directing, guest episodic directing, which has been absolutely incredible. I mean, I really, the 4 years that it took, I was 4 years between being on the set of Laggies and being on this, and I got on that set of Outside In, and I just hadn't really realized
how much
of an impact television had had until I got on the set of that movie, because I was like, I feel so different than I did the last time I was doing a movie. Just sense of confidence and ease. And, definitely don't want to diss my previous movies. I love them all, but it was a little bit more of a angsty process. Honestly, there was more stress on set because I just didn't have the same level of experience. I've been on set constantly over the past 4 years. That's kind of how it's felt,
Yeah, yeah. I see that. You mentioned Megan that you pitched this thing that you both worked on. I just talked to her for her new film.
Great.
Which is
Sadie.
Nice. And you shared
great film.
Yeah, and you shared another, and she went full drama. Well, she does more dramas, I guess, in general.
Yeah, but she did Lucky Them, which is a comedy.
But. She did, you shared your editor, is that right?
Celia Beasley. Yeah.
Okay. I'm mentioning her again because I was supposed to interview them both in Austin. And I had an emergency and I had to cancel. And then, so I just want to put out there that she's welcome on.
Celia's amazing. Yeah. She's become the,
Seattle.
Amazing.
Is she like a local Seattle?
She is. Yeah. So it was wonderful because it was 3 minutes from my house. So I could just go to her house. Sort of, she has a great edit suite up in her garret. And it was just
nice.
View of the mountains if I ever need a little breath of, air. And it was just, she's an amazing collaborator. Yeah. And I've known her for years through Megan and she have been friends for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And she's edited other stuff like shorts and stuff. And so it was really nice to finally get to actually work with her. It was wonderful.
And your cinematographer?
Nate
Miller.
Yeah. So first time I've worked with Nate.
He was there at South By. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I've amazing. Just absolutely incredible talent. My first six films were shot by the great Ben Kasulke.
Yeah.
And he wasn't available when I was getting this scheduled. And I actually was having a hard time figuring out, who's going to fill those shoes? Because Ben has always been a great collaborator.
Right.
And it was really interesting how... So Nate and I have known each other for a very long time, probably almost as long as I've known Ben. And he's been a camera operator for me. He's been on many of my sets.
Oh, right. That's right.
Doing a lot of different things. Yeah. Mm. Usually camera operating, but also he's filled other roles too. When we had tiny crews, he would also, help with the lights and whatever, needed to be done. And just an amazing trooper and just an incredible, just a really grounding presence for me. He just has this sort of character and this personality that I find very soothing to be around, quite honestly. And that then he stopped working on my sets because he really wanted to make a full transition to director of photography. And he collaborated with some directors on some beautiful films. There's a great film by Ross Partridge called Lamb that he did incredible job with. And among others. And I sort of, it was really interesting because the tea was available and I was like, I think this is, I've always wanted to work with him as DP and it was like, this might be the opportunity. And it was just heaven. It was just heaven. I just had a great, great time working with him. And in fact, we're about to work together again this spring on another one.
Oh.
So yeah.
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 On
a comedy. It'll be improvised dialogue, much like in the form of Hump Day. It's something that I haven't had a burning desire to do until the desire started building and building and building. And then very recently it's gotten very burning and I've been collecting, people who, I know can do it because not everybody can improvise. And I have this really great, amazing cast of folks who can. And I'm super, super excited and it's full on comedy. I mean, I've basically, since I just directed this as my first feature, drama, I'm definitely like, okay, let myself go in the other direction and it's going to go in some wacky places and, I'm letting myself really have fun with it.
So. Oh, good. Wait, yeah. Where are you shooting that one?
Not in Washington State. My first film outside of Washington State. Just
really?
The narrative is kind of based.
Okay.
It needs to be in a different region. So.
I understand. Okay. Somewhere outside. So you've narrowed it down. Thank you for that. And I was going to ask you, drop one name that you, who among these great improvisers, I said, okay, I'll take a location because I know she's not going to tell me that somebody who's in it. Well, Lynn Shelton is the director of and co-writer of this new drama called Outside In, which stars Edie Falco, Jay Duplass, and Caitlin Deaver.
And Ben Schwartz.
Ben Schwartz is the brother that we were talking about. Chris's brother, or Jay Duplass's character's brother, and many other folks. Matt Malloy, a recognizable character. And it's being distributed by The Archer. And it's going to be at the Quad Cinema right here in New York. And Lynn Shelton is going to be at the Quad. That's a fantastic opportunity to meet Lynn. And she will talk to you. She will afterwards. she'll be happy to hang out and take all your questions and then it's opening also at the Lumley Soho
NoHo
in LA. We have Soho, they have NoHo,
right?
7 in LA and then hopefully maybe even other spots, but it will also
now, second weekend and the 6th
Seattle,
it'll also
be Seattle.
It'll be in Seattle. Mm-hmm. It was all going to be in one weekend and I said, could you divide it up? I want to be in Seattle to support it.
Of course you do.
Next weekend I'll be in Seattle on the 6th, and then Portland on the 7th, and Vancouver, Washington as well for the late afternoon one. And it will open in a bunch of other places in the, like Bellingham and Eugene, a lot of other little spots around Port Orchard in the Pacific Northwest, which is great because it's a very Northwesty movie.
Right.
But other places too. It's going to be in a few festivals, the Ashland Film Festival, the Cascadia Film Festival, and then it's also going to be in like Chicago and just various places.
I like
places.
When that happens. I like that festivals, nice. Some festivals are still open even if the film is opening around. Because, you know, filmmakers are making independent films really need that because that's kind of an extended theatrical for a lot of people. In some cases, it's all they get. For me, screenings,
I think it's the big payoff is to sit with an audience and watch the film and then interact with the audience afterwards. I love it.
Everybody I talk to loves it. So why is it that it's hard to anyway?
Yeah.
But there's always hope. I believe.
Yes.
Oh, I was going to just say. Oh, so you know, I realized I screwed at the very beginning, and I wanted to just say again, I will be following up on Hump Day. Whatever we call this follow-up, it will be nice.
Hump Day 2. Electric Boogaloo.
Electric Boogaloo. That's a good... and at least I know that I'll probably get you back on the podcast for that. No, you'll come back on.
All three of us will have to come back for that one.
Yeah, that's right. That would be nice.
Yeah.
Because he's... You know, the other guy is... I've never been on, and I feel a little bit...
Oh, well, it's about time then, huh?
It is.
Well, thanks, Adam, for having me. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you very much. And good luck with the film. You know.
Thank you.
Sure.
A lot of guys get out and think they're free. But you're not free yet. Not by a long shot.
Okay. You go up here to file?
Mm-hmm. So what is the most different?
Smartphones, whatever everyone's obsessed with.
What was it like? How'd you get through it?
Your mom is what got me through it.
Where were you?
I was with Chris.
Oh.
I'd rather you not bring your charity work home.
Come on, put it on.
Get out of here. Gracias.
Simple life. Come home every day to somebody that I love and be good to them. I want you.
Chris, I have to save my marriage.
Oh my God. Tom, we can be friends.
We're not friends. You're the only person I can talk to. You're everything to me.
You have a whole big new life in front of you. Possibly know that it's me that you want.
Sam Pollard is it seems has never been busier or more prolific. It seemed like only what was it? Sam was originally on the first episode he was on was back in August of 2014, episode number 232, where he just came on where we just chatted about film. And just had a great time. Then he came back in December. Well, he came back in the fall of 2016 on episode 382. And we talked about Two Trains Running. Now, last year at Tribeca Film Festival, I believe it was, I saw Acorn and the Firestorm, which is about the demise of this organization, Acorn. And then I had to wait and wait. And finally, I saw, what did I see? I saw a couple more. All of a sudden, his documentary on Sammy Davis Jr., called Sammy Davis Jr., I've Got to Be Me. I saw that at, I think, Doc NYC last November. And then I saw Maynard, which is about the former Atlanta, Georgia mayor, Maynard Jackson. And I saw that. I must have been given a link for that. Anyway, here's my point. Acorn and the Firestorm is going to have a theatrical run at the Metrograph Cinema in New York City. It's a hidden camera video involving, it's about this, the Acorn and the Firestorm, according to its IMDb page, a hidden camera video involving a fake prostitute threatens to destroy Acorn, America's largest grassroots anti-poverty organization. It's a very timely film, to say the least. You'll see why when you go see this. And it will be at the Metrograph Theater beginning Friday, April 6th. So that's a week from now. And Sam, I should mention this at the top, that this film was not solely directed by Sam, but he was also co-directed by Ruben Atlas. And Ruben was on this show many years ago with the Brothers Hypnotic episode way back in episode 138 back in 2013. But on this episode, we're going to talk to Sam about Acorn and the Firestorm. We're going to talk to him about Sammy Davis Jr. And we're going to talk to him about Maynard Jackson. Maynard is also going to be at the Full Frame Documentary Festival. Is having a screening on Saturday, April 7th at 1:20 in the afternoon. If you're heading to the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival, which is located in Durham, North Carolina. I have no doubt that there's going to be a lot more coming from Sam, because both of these films, Maynard and Sammy Davis Jr., have yet to have theatricals or any kind of releases here in New York. So I think there's going to be a lot coming out in 2018 with Mr. Pollard. But, you know, this is my conversation for his third visit. Sam Pollard here on Film Wax Radio. You have two documentaries right now at DocMYC, which is going on right now. You have Sammy Davis Jr., I Gotta Be Me, and if that were enough, you also have the documentary Maynard. Now, did you direct both of these or co-direct?
Well, I submitted both of them to festivals, and Mr. Powers and his programmers invited both of them.
But correct me if I'm wrong, when I was at Tribeca Film Festival earlier this year, I believe I saw a documentary of yours called Acorn.
And the Firestorm.
Acorn and the Firestorm. And by the way, I ran into you at the Woodstock Film Festival recently. Did you happen to see that other documentary? I'm forgetting the title.
The Organizer?
A little competition on the subject matter.
No, not that I wasn't interested. I just didn't have time. It was only in Woodstock a day and a half.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to see Sammy Davis Jr. when I was at Woodstock. However, I couldn't, you know, make it over to that town.
Right. It was the one that was at the theater where we had the interview before for Two Trains last year.
When you look at the stretch of coincidences about the trip and what happened afterwards, it reads like a very badly written novel. Who would believe it?
In those days, we were the only ones who knew about these people. It was like being in a secret society. You know, now Robert Johnson's been on a postage stamp. But at that time, you know, it was just, who?
The good news is I finally did catch up with Sammy Davis Jr. I Gotta Be Me here at DocMYC, and I haven't gotten to see Maynard, to be completely honest, but
yeah, sure.
I look forward to catching up with that one in the next few days.
Good.
I haven't seen Maynard yet, but I know enough about the story, and I've watched some clips, so let's begin with that documentary.
I believe that politics is the last viable means of nonviolent social change for black people in this country.
Atlanta was as segregated as any small town in the South. Totally segregated society.
Maynard Jackson came at a time that we were going from just protest to political power.
Citizens of Atlanta elected a man they thought could best do the job as mayor.
I will be governor.
He was born to be great.
By what is my conviction?
He was taught to be great.
He's the city's first black mayor. His name is Maynard Jackson.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. Mayor.
Atlanta was the capital of the South. For him to win and really call shots, it was huge.
He helped to build Atlanta into the great city it is today.
Today's victory, and it is a victory.
Maynard Jackson Jr. had the distinction of being the first African American mayor of a southern city. Is that true?
The first African American mayor of a major southern city, Atlanta, Georgia, for three terms.
And this isn't recent. This goes back quite a while, does it not?
Back in 1973.
I mean, how significant is that?
Well, it's a monumental thing because, you know, I was saying to someone a few weeks ago, around 1975, I had been asked to work on a little documentary that was directed by Gordon Parks' son, David Parks, okay. Gordon Parks Jr. And he was doing a documentary about, at that time, three black mayors of major cities. It was Coleman Young of Detroit, Michigan, Tom Bradley of Los Angeles, California, and Maynard Jackson Jr. of Atlanta, Georgia. So that's when I first became aware of Maynard Jackson, when I was 24, 25 years old. So, you know, it's those kind of things. It's a funny kind of, you know, connection that almost 50 years later, I was approached by Wendy Jackson, the wife of Maynard Jackson III, Maynard's son, about doing a documentary about Maynard Jackson. So I said, you know, like, she's a producer, and she approached me, and I said, well, you know, the big challenge is to raise the money. Right. You know, I think he's a fabulous man, important person in history, historical person, the story need to be told. I said, if you can raise the money, I'll be on board. And it took about 6 months to raise the initial money, and we did our first shoots, I think, in the fall of 2015. We interviewed Andrew Young, who was the second black mayor of Atlanta, an ambassador. We interviewed Reverend Sharpton. We interviewed Vernon Jordan, who's a very close friend of Bill Clinton, and who grew up with Maynard Jackson in Atlanta. Oh, okay. And we interviewed Reverend Joseph Lowry, one of the important figures during the historic civil rights movement. Right. And we interviewed Maynard's former wife, Bunny Jackson, Ransom, and his widow, Valerie Jackson. Right. So that was our first set of interviews. And then they sort of had a struggle to raise more money. And we didn't really start interviewing again until almost summer, fall of 2016. And then all of a sudden, it just started an avalanche of money and people we interviewed. We interviewed other friends. We interviewed his other children. We interviewed Jesse Jackson. We interviewed President Clinton. And things just started to fall into place. So we, between the fall of 2016 and probably August of 2017, we did about 30 interviews.
Fortunately, you know a good editor. Did you edit the Maynard by yourself, or did you?
No, we were able to. There was a young man in Atlanta. He's not so young anymore, but there's a gentleman in Atlanta named Jeff Cooper, who had been my assistant, one of my assistants when I was editing Spike's Features, who'd become an editor. And they had mentioned Jeff to me, and initially I was hesitant because of the snob I am, the New York snob. I said, well, we want a New York editor. But then changed around. I said, well, let's see how Jeff works out. And Jeff did a phenomenal job. He started editing February 2017 and basically finished in this right in the fall.
Well, I'm really actually looking forward to catching up with it as you just talk about it. Now, it's the film Maynard Jackson Jr., Maynard, about the life and the career of Maynard Jackson Jr., is mostly comprised of archive and talking head interviews. Of those talking head interviews, how much of them were you the one in doing the actual interviews?
I interviewed every one of them. Mm-hmm. Every one of the interviews I did, you know. And it was, you know, it was an eye opener because one of the things I would say to people, you know, I interviewed Mayor Shirley Franklin, you know, who was the fourth mayor and
of Atlanta.
And she was waxing on about Maynard and how wonderful he was, how this he was. And I said, at one point I asked the question, I said, well, was he really happy when he did that third term as mayor? And she said, I thought you were making a positive piece about Maynard. I said, no, I want the truth. You know, I don't want it to be all fluff. Yeah. And so we started rolling the cameras and she said, Maynard hated the third term. You know, and it was like, you know, it was just refreshing for people to understand that I'm not trying to just make a piece about Maynard that was going to make him look great. I interviewed one of the mothers who lost a child during the Atlanta child murders. And when we sat down to do that interview, she said to me, well, are you really going to keep this interview in the film? because everybody wants to say such wonderful things about Maine. I said, no, we want to hear your side. Yeah. And one of the things she says in the film is that her and other parents who had lost children felt that Maine didn't do enough at the beginning, when, you know, looking for the person who was the culprit. Yeah. You know, and so this was during the second term.
Okay.
Second term. And she didn't feel that Maine wasn't doing enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and they confronted him. They went down to City Hall and confronted him.
Were they middle class African Americans?
No, working class family members.
Understood.
Who had lost their children. You know.
Yeah. Sure.
So they didn't feel he was doing enough. And even Reverend Laurie says if she hadn't loved Maine so much, he would have been picketing, you know, doing the Atlanta child murders. So it was important to see all aspects of Maynard.
Sure.
You know? I interviewed Douglas Blackman, who wrote the book Slavery by Another Name, that's based on the film we did. And he was a journalist, of course, a journalist at that time in Maynard, during Maynard's third term. And he dug deep into Maynard's, you know, city government and found scandal, you know.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to turn away from that. So I try to give you everything about Maynard.
I mean, is there any case of where a mayor of a major city who goes through two, three terms or one term? How long is the term? Anyway, of any amount of time in a major city devoid of any scandal?
It's impossible. He never got caught. He was never indicted of anything,
right,
but
right.
There were people. Yeah. It was swirling around him.
Yeah.
It's impossible.
I mean, at some point, the head has got to get cut off.
Somebody's got to. Yeah. Somebody. Some heads have to roll.
So, how was interviewing Sharpton?
He didn't know Maynard that well, so he's really basically the beginning of the film. You know, he didn't really know him that well.
Yeah.
He knew him sort of tangentially, but it was good to get Sharpton, Reverend Sharpton,
right.
In the film.
President Clinton, what was that experience like?
Clinton was really good on Maynard. Clinton knew Maynard Jackson.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, Clinton knew him well. Jesse knew him really well. So you got these guys to talk about him in some very, you know, human and honest terms.
But Sam, is there anyone better suited for a talking head interview than Bill Clinton?
Jesse Jackson, Shirley Franklin.
They're all fantastic.
They're all great on camera.
Yeah.
Both of his wives, his former wife
yeah.
and his widow, they're great. His son, Buzzy, who is interesting, Maynard III, he's interesting because he had a very contentious relationship with his father.
Yeah.
He didn't follow those rules. He got arrested for selling marijuana. He had drug issues. And we deal with that in the film, too.
Yeah.
So to me, it felt like I had to deal with a lot of stuff in this man's life. You know,
The way you've been describing the man, Maynard Jackson, and his relationships... And his family life, you could have been talking about Sammy Davis Jr.
I do.
Well, Sam, one thing, I mean, it's so great. I walked out of that screening really just feeling very satisfied, like I just had a good meal, because I'd gotten such a fuller, more broad idea of what this human being was all about.
I'm colored, Jewish, and Puerto Rican. When I move into a neighborhood, I wipe it out.
Sammy Davis Jr.'s whole life was about confronting obstacles.
Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangles. Mr. Bojangles, come back and dance.
His gift was his talent. The curse was being black in America.
It's no fun to walk into a place you're going to play and be told that we've had 14 bomb threats.
Even if you win, you don't win.
He said, these people are going to love me as an entertainer, no matter how much they may hate me as a black.
If I could have lived in the 20s with Valentino, I would have had the leopards on a leash, you know, walking down the street.
Sammy was show business from the tip of his toes to the top of his head.
If you played it for her, you can play it for me, you understand?
Sammy's like, I'm a black guy, but I'm going to imitate a white guy.
You dirty rat.
Because at this point, we're left with just, you know, these impersonations, caricatures of him by Billy Crystal and other people who've impersonated him over the years. So it was a nice contrast to really get the whole person here, you know, in your movie, something you do really well. Speaking of impersonations, I did not know that Sammy Davis Jr. himself, early in his career, did impersonations and was fantastic at it, by the way.
What I didn't know was that back then when he started doing those impressions, that a black man wasn't looked upon as someone should be doing white people.
Yes, back then, doing a black man doing impersonations of a white celebrity, you know, was considered controversial.
That's right. I didn't know that. So when he tells that story to David Frost about the reaction of his father, Sammy Davis Sr., and Will Mastin, don't you, when he came off the stage.
The audiences went crazy, but his father was not so crazy about him doing those impersonations.
Well, they loved it. That's right. And his father and his uncle says, don't you ever do those impressions again. And he says, why, Dad? Why, Dad? They love me. You know, he said, well, Mastin rubbed his leg saying, don't do those again, you know, because it was, as Margot Jeffson says, it was groundbreaking. Yeah. It was groundbreaking. I mean, a black man to be doing Jimmy Cagney, Edward G. Robinson, Jimmy Stewart, you know, Humphrey Bogart, and then to have the opportunity to go to Humphrey Bogart, to be at Humphrey Bogart's house, and Humphrey Bogart says, you're not doing me.
Yeah, Bogart says no. You got it close, but you don't. You're here's how you can improve it a little. Your impersonation a little bit.
So it's fascinating.
Just
so
amazing.
To me, you know, it shows
just phenomenal.
You, as I was saying to an audience last night at the screening at Doc NYC yesterday, the thing that's fascinating about Sammy Davis Jr. is that with all of this phenomenal talent, there was also all this insecurity, all this, you know, wanting to be accepted.
Yeah, well, one example of his insecurities was going back, and this is depicted in the film, which is again called Sammy Davis Jr., I Gotta Be Me. Sammy Davis Jr. was a big supporter going back of Kennedy, much like his buddies in the Rat Pack. Specifically, we know that Frank Sinatra was very close to Kennedy. And then Sammy was sort of rejected, wasn't he?
Because think about this. Here's a man at the age of 3 is introduced to applause, introduced to gratification, and becomes a person who loves to be out there and loves the applause of an audience. Here's a man who, instead of doing a 40-minute set, would do an hour and a half set, right? Here's a man that would hug anybody who would say, Sammy, we love you. The man was always looking for love. You know, so he's rejected by Kennedy, and a mere 12 years later, he's embraced by Nixon. He's not thinking politically.
Right.
He's not thinking politically in that moment.
Right.
He's thinking, someone's from the White House is embracing me, you know.
It's love.
You know, it's love. It's like what he says when that little piece, when he's right before he does Candyman, he says...
It's a highlight in the film.
It's a highlight.
That archive is just...
It's fantastic. But when he says, this is as far as uptown I'm ever going to get.
Yeah.
That's all he's looking for success. He's looking for affirmation.
Yeah.
You know? And even if Richard Nixon, for most of us, was an evil man, to Sammy, it was like, they've invited me to the White House. Right. They invited me to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom.
First African American to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, correct?
That's what he says. That's what he looks for. You know, here's the man, as they say in the film. The problem with being a black man in the 20th century is that you had to walk this duality of trying to make it and understanding that you need to figure out how to hold onto yourself at the same time as you want to be white. And Sammy, in somewhere in his head, wanted to be white. Yeah. As the guy says, he didn't want to just be the Jewish Frank Sinatra.
Right.
He wanted to be the black Frank Sinatra. You know?
He started when he was a baby, essentially. He was so little, being brought out on stage by, you know, his father. They were, of course, in showbiz. And there was no doubt, watching that early footage, that this kid is a prodigy.
He's a prodigy.
Just the most naturally talented person you can think of.
Yeah.
So what was it? Was he just neglected as a baby? I mean, or a youngster, you know, by the family? What accounts for this insatiable appetite that he had for affirmation, for love? How do you explain it?
No, it's not neglect. No, it's but think of it this way. Why do some people become performers? Because what happens?
The addiction to adulation.
That's right. You go out there and someone says you do a song and dance when you're 6 years old. Oh, they said, you're so beautiful. Oh, you're so wonderful. The next time you go out and do a song and dance at seven, oh, you're so great. You're so wonderful. What happens in your head? You know, someone says, why don't you do that comedy routine again? Ah, you do it. You know, you're looking for that applause. You know, and that's what happened with Sammy. His affirmation came from an audience. For Will Masters and Sammy Davis Sr. taking him around on the circuit, on the Chitlin circuit, from place to place, and having people say, oh, isn't he so cute?
He's pretty cute.
You know, he was. And Rufus Jones going those girls to Washington, he's fantastic. He's the best thing in the film.
Hanging out with Sinatra and those guys increased his cool factor.
He's one of the boys.
We stick together like glue.
Sammy saw himself as somebody who was breaking new ground for black people, but there was definitely the perception that he was a sellout.
Anytime you walk down the street and your own people turn you away, then all the money, the diamonds, the fame, the fortune mean absolutely nothing.
He couldn't be accepted in the white community. He couldn't be accepted in the black community, but he had a vision for himself that was bigger than white or black.
Now I would like to sing, if you would like for me to sing.
Ethel Waters is damn good, but Sammy takes it. And that it's not about neglect. It's about all of a sudden everyone says, oh, you're so cute. Oh, you're so wonderful. Oh, you're so talented. It gets in your head.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, it was the adulation and the constant outpouring of love was there from the very beginning. As far back as he can remember, it's ingrained in his DNA.
It gets ingrained.
It's not like he started, as a young adult and then went into showbiz.
It gets ingrained, but did he, you know, but what happens is, you know, when I was reading his book, Yes, I Can, his first autobiography, yeah. Sammy would say that when he got off the stage, he couldn't go home and just be alone. He needed to be surrounded by people. So we'd have all the people in the chorus, or if he was doing Mr. Wonderful or Golden Boy, come over to my house. Let's have a party. Let's hang out. Because that's what he needed, you know? The neglect for him was to be alone. He didn't want to be alone. That's why he couldn't survive a marriage with My Britt, because he had to be out there. I mean, think about it this way. He does Golden Boy in the mid-60s, right?
On Broadway.
He's also doing, you know, touring, right? Mm-hmm. He's also producing and starring in The Man Called Adam. He's also has his NBC show. The guy's out of his mind.
He's the one now
neglecting
correct?
The family.
Sure.
Why? Because Sammy Davis needs this constant affirmation. We love you. We love you. We love you.
Meanwhile, he is breaking racial barriers and perhaps serving a greater good.
Sure, he was breaking racial barriers.
I don't know that it was a conscious agenda, but he was indeed changing the world in his own way.
Yeah, but it was the aftermath. But he was, it's like his success, his need for the love meant more than having to deal with his family. That's clear. It's clear, you know? Success, that kind of like, you know, people loving you, grabbing you, holding you, wanting your autograph. It meant more to him than anything else in his life.
Well, fortunately for the kids, they had a very strong mother.
And a strong mother.
So maybe as they became adults, they were able to understand their father, at least intellectually.
Well, as adults. Because if you read Tracy Davis's book, she has some very complicated feelings about her father. And I tried to interview her for the film.
She wouldn't.
She put me through such a ringer, you know. She lives in Nashville. She finally says she'll do an interview. I said, why don't I come to Nashville? She says, sure. I hire crew. She wants makeup. I hire makeup. I go down to Nashville early morning to meet the crew. She even recommends the location, this wonderful old hotel. We go and we find the room at the hotel. We set up the cameras, set up the lights, set up the sound. Makeup comes. We're waiting. She's supposed to come at 12:30. No Tracy. 12:45, no Tracy. I text, I call, no response. I send the production assistant to her apartment building. And I say, put your finger on her buzzer and see if she'll come down. I text Tracy and says, I'm having the PA come to your apartment. Just come down and tell her either you're coming or you're not. And if you're coming, she'll drive you to the interview and we'll have her drive you back. She never responded.
To this day.
to the date. She never That's responded. Awful. So obviously there's some deep-seated complications that she has for her dad.
Well, it's wonderful that Sammy Davis Jr., I Gotta Be Me, will be on American Masters, so a lot of people will get to see the film.
It's been seen, I'm telling you, man. I showed it in Toronto. It premiered in Toronto Film Festival. Then 2 weeks later, I took it to Haifa in Israel. Haifa International Film Festival.
That makes sense. It's going to be in a lot of Jewish festivals.
And they ate it up. They loved it. Yeah. Then I came back. I took it to the Chicago International Film Festival and showed it there. Great reaction. Then I came back, showed it in the Philadelphia International Film Festival. Great reaction. Then 2 weekends ago, I showed it in the St. Louis International Film Festival. Great reaction, you know.
Woodstock.
Then this past weekend, AFI Fest. I showed it on Saturday. It's getting such positive reaction, and part of it surprises me.
Well, you know, the experience of watching it, Sam, it's like a narrative film unfolding. It's such an amazing, dramatic story. It's full of so much comedy and drama.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, lots of famous people in it talking about Sammy Davis Jr. or in the archives. So it's a very entertaining film to watch.
And, you know, Kim Novak still says they were just friends.
We know better.
I think we do.
Anybody you couldn't get that you wish you had been able to get in the film?
Mr. Belafonte. I emailed him. I called him. You know, I know Harry. I called a close friend of mine who edits for Harry. And she reached out to him for me, and he turned us down. But fortunately, when I had edited the four-hour Frank Sinatra doc that Mr. Gibney directed, took a long time, but we got Harry to say yes to Gibney, and he only would do it. We only did audio recording with Harry, so I was able to get access to the audio recording, and luckily it talked about Sammy and the Rat Pack.
So at this point, you're a Rat Pack expert, right, Sam?
Well, but you think about it this way, Adam. I grew up, you know, I'm 67 years old, 1960. I saw Ocean's 11 in the movies. I saw it in the movie.
That's odd. George Clooney just doesn't look that old.
I saw it in the movie. I saw Sergeant's Three, you know. I saw Robin and the Seven Hoods. You know, I'd seen Sammy Davis on the Ed Sullivan Show. I saw him on the Mike Douglas Show. I saw him on the Dinah Shore Show. I saw him in Hollywood Palace. In the 60s, I read Yes, I Can when I was 16.
Really?
Yeah, when it came out in 65. Okay. I read Yes, I Can. So,
as the joke in Spinal Tap goes, yes, I can if Mr. Sinatra says I can.
That's right.
You remember that moment, right?
With
Bruno Kirby, Bruno Kirby's line in Spinal Tap.
Bruno Kirby did it. But the thing I was thinking about this, there were two black men that really touched me in the 60s. On that entertainment spectrum, it was Sammy Davis Jr. On the artistic, you know, spectrum, it was Gordon Parks. You look behind you, see my Gordon Parks book.
Yes.
Half Past Autumn. And I had read his book, you know, A Choice of Weapons. So these were two black men that I was like, wow, heroes for me. And as Margot Jepson says in the film, when Sammy Davis Jr. came on TV for people in the black community, that was a big thing.
Did you ever get a chance to meet him?
No, I never met him.
I don't know. I was thinking maybe while you were on one of the Spike Lee, when you were making one of the Spike movies, perhaps you had an opportunity to meet him.
No, never.
He died in 94.
Yeah, I never met him.
Another shock, of course, is how just young he died.
64 years old.
He was only 64. It's just kind of amazing, I guess, because he started just so young. He's just been in my life so many years.
Well, Sinatra lived a long time.
The odds are if he had taken better care of himself, he hadn't smoked, he could have been around another 10, 20 years easily. So it sounds like while you were trying to raise money for the Maynard doc, and took a break from that you were working on the Sammy Davis Jr. documentary.
On Sammy at the same time. Yeah.
And you've got this gig here at NYU, where we're recording today.
Yeah, and I was also working on Acorn.
Yeah, Ruben was on this podcast before.
Acorn, I called it Ruben Atlas.
So it seems as though possibly, Sam Pollard, you share something in common with Mr. Davis in that you are remarkably productive and busy, and I maybe have a slightly more patient wife and family.
She has been very patient with me because this particular period of time, I've been away a lot.
Yeah, this is an unusually prolific period. Even by Alex Gibney standards, this is particularly prolific.
I know, man. It's like three films in 1 year. You know, three films.
Okay, thank you, Sam. And I look forward to all these movies coming out in 2018. Until next time.
It's my pleasure always to be on the show. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning into this show. I hope you're subscribed, because coming up on the next episode of the podcast, or at least on the next couple of episodes of the podcast, I want to mention that we have Lynn Ramsey. The great filmmaker Lynn Ramsey will be on the show. Lynn is, of course, known for Mover and Caller, and she did Ratcatcher, and a movie called We Need to Talk About Heaven. Well, she's back with a new film called You Were Never Really Here, which stars Joaquin Phoenix and is, oh, it's a very exciting film. So we're going to have her on. She's, I've been wanting to have on Lynn Ramsey since I started this whole thing, you know? So she'll be coming on. We have Andrew Dosunmu, who is making his second appearance. He was on with Mother of George some time ago. He's back with a new film called Where is Kira, which I can tell you also is thoroughly fun and, I mean, thoroughly watchable movie with a very, very unusually casted Michelle Pfeiffer and Kiefer Sutherland. And we also have coming up on the show, Andrew High, who is, of course, the director of Weekend and 45 Years, and, of course, the HBO series Looking. He's back with this new film. It's called Lean on Pete, and it's great. And joining Andrew is the lead actor from Lean on Pete, Charlie Plummer, who you will know from All the Money in the World. This is a very busy young actor. Charlie has not only has he got one of the main roles in All the Money in the World as John Paul Getty Jr., he's the one that's kidnapped, and he's amazing in it. But he's also in, he was in King Jack, which was his sort of breakout film. And he did The Dinner, which was Orrin Moverman's movie. So I'm very excited to bring on both Andrew and Charlie Plummer onto the podcast, both making their first appearances. So all that is coming up just in the next couple of episodes. And as I mentioned, we'll get that conversation with the Criterion Now host, Aaron West, up as well. And, you know, all the South by coverage, a lot of South by Southwest coverage yet to be posted in the coming weeks. So please continue to stay tuned to the show. In the meantime, take care of yourself and the ones you love. This is your host, Adam Shartoff, wishing you the best. Take care. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols.